What's my subscription to the New York Times have me doing this week? Preparing a strawberry pretzel pie. Solving spelling bee with no hints. Planning a trip to one of the 52 best places to go. Getting to the bottom of the big pants trend.
Whoa.
And I'm finally replacing my vacuum with a recommendation I can trust. What will your subscription to the Times have you do? Why not find out? With our best offer, go to nytimes.com/subscribe.
From the New York Times, I'm Michael Barbaro. This is The Daily. Today, how a piece of paper is gaining increasing power over the American worker and can turn a life's work into a liability. And the president returns to Washington with some family business to attend to. It's Wednesday, May 31st. Tell me a little bit about the history of the textile industry in North Carolina.
Well, at one point, North Carolina is the textile capital of the world, but it kind of declined now. My name is Keith Bollinger. I've been in textiles in North Carolina since 1982. I first started with textiles shortly after I graduated from high school at a company called the Geltman Corporation, just an entry-level job, a manual labor job. You know, I didn't know if I was going to even stay in textiles. I was just a kid, but I kept getting promoted. So, you know, it turned into a career. I had taken a pay cut when the economy tanked.
During the Great Recession.
Right. They cut everybody's pay by 35-40%. And in the meantime, I got an offer from a company about 5 miles away for manufacturing manager running the plant. So it was a big promotion for me. It was a big opportunity. So I accepted the job. But that backfired on me big time.
Keith says that after only a few weeks at his new job,
one day a gentleman shows up and asks for me, and he hands me an envelope and says, "You've been served."
Keith had violated his non-compete clause.
So a non-compete clause is basically this little thing inside of your big employment contract, and it says you can't go work for the competition. You can't go work for the other guy.
Connor Doherty covers economics for the Times. So at this point, how many people in the American economy are being asked to sign a non-compete, if you know?
So the best data we have is that about 1 in 5 people is covered by these. If anything, that's an underestimate. And the reason is a lot of people don't even know. I mean, it's sort of like asking you, did you read your cable bill? A lot of people don't read the fine print.
Did you know what it was you were signing?
Well, I knew it was a non-compete, but they had a whole slew of these things all at once. And nobody really sat down and explained everything, you know, like they handed it to me and I read it. But I trusted them, so I signed it.
These things started with executives and, you know, high-up scientists and, you know, people who really could absolutely crush a company if they took all their secrets to another place. But now they're moving down to, you know, in some cases, sandwich makers, people who shovel dirt, people who cut hair. Best I can tell, it's everywhere.
My new employer was advised by his attorney that he had better lay me off to keep from getting drug into the lawsuit. So I lost my job.
One of the more extraordinary cases I came across is this guy, Keith Bollinger.
It was the best job I'd ever had. Fit me like a glove.
And it's extraordinary because he had this legal odyssey with his company. They fought back and forth in court, spent hundreds of thousands of dollars for 3.5 years, almost 4 years.
The financial burden that this has caused me, there's no way I can ever recoup from it totally. And the lawsuit didn't stop while I was unemployed. So I had to keep paying an attorney. And that wiped us out. You know, it wiped out our life savings.
So 3 years of all this drama and heartache because this document was put in front of you and you signed it.
Yes.
Connor, doesn't a non-compete clause just by definition end up stifling competition and then hurt every company?
Well, to be fair, a lot of companies would say, I spent a lot of money on training you. And I'm spending that money on training you with the expectation that you will stay around for a while. right? But that's what the economic data seems to show.
Connor, you're based in Silicon Valley. You cover it. I would imagine that non-competes are pretty widely used in kind of high-tech industries like that. Is that the case?
You would think that non-competes would be all over Silicon Valley, but they're not. In fact, a lot of people say that they're a reason the Silicon Valley exists, and that's because California law prohibits non-competes. I mean, a lot of people say the Silicon Valley started when a bunch of people bailed a New York company called Fairchild Semiconductor to create a new company called Intel. Well, in a lot of states, it would be illegal for a bunch of guys who work at a company to get together and say, meh, you know what, let's go across the street and start our own company doing the exact same thing.
Mm-hmm.
But if that hadn't happened, and if it hadn't continued happening, we might not have a Silicon Valley today, or at least that's part of the argument. And also, you know, there's kind of this big, broader, like kind of philosophical question, which is, aren't we sort of better off in the economy when knowledge gets shared around?
There will be people listening to this who will say, you were asked to sign a document, but you didn't have to. And what would you say?
Well, I felt like I had to, the way it was presented to me.
Mm-hmm.
Besides that, I trusted the people that I had been working for 2 decades.
Mm-hmm.
And I had no idea that later on I would have to take such a drastic pay cut and not be able to go anywhere else in the only industry that I knew.
Mm-hmm.
Look, I'm just a guy with a high school education. I'm not a chemist. I'm not a specialist in anything. I just, you know, started off entry level and worked my way up. I'm just an average schmuck.
You're not a schmuck.
Well,
that much is clear.
Okay. Thank you.
So what is the lesson of a case like Keith Bollinger's and his non-compete clause?
Here's the lesson I take from this. Increasingly, companies want to own your work experience. Like, if you go work for any company, you and I, all of our stuff is owned by the New York Times. It's all copyrighted to the New York Times. So we accept that. You know, that's fine that you own the product I made, and it's fine that you own the copyrights to all the stuff, or you own the intellectual secrets even, right? But why do you get to own that I know how to do the thing?
I wonder what you've said or would say to anybody who's asked to sign one of these documents now.
I've told my son, and of course my son has witnessed all of this. He's in college right now. My son, never sign a non-compete.
What does your son want to do after college, if he knows, if you know?
Oh, he's majoring in computer science and minoring in business.
Could be a non-compete kind of world.
Could be.
Keith, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Okay, sure thing. Thank you. Have a good day.
Earlier this month, after 3.5 years of litigation, Keith Bollinger's case was settled, and he can safely return to his new job. In an email, TSG Finishing, the company that sued Bollinger for violating his non-compete agreement, said it was, quote, committed to ethical business practices and will protect ourselves from illegal business tactics that threaten the livelihood of the 150-plus families who depend on us. We'll be right back.
My name is Jasmine Ulloa, and I'm a national politics reporter for The New York Times. I grew up in Texas, on the border with Mexico, and I've been reporting in the region since I was in high school. Now I travel the country looking for stories and voices that really capture what immigration and the nation's demographic changes mean for people. What I keep encountering is that voters don't fall into neat ideological boxes on this very volatile issue. There's a lot of gray. And that's where I feel the most interesting stories are. I'm trying to bring that complexity and nuance to our audience, especially in such a critical election year. And that's really what all of my colleagues on the politics team and every journalist at the New York Times is aiming to do. Our mission is to help you understand the world, no matter how complicated it might be. If you want to support this mission, consider subscribing to The New York Times. You can do that at nytimes.com/subscribe.
Phil.
Yeah, to the issue of the Russia probe, I'm wondering, Sean, if you can tell us when the president knew, whether the president knew at the time that Jared Kushner was seeking to establish back-channel communications at the Russian embassy to the Russian government. And if he didn't know at the time, when did he find out?
I think that assumes a lot, and I would just say that Mr. Kushner's attorney has said that Mr. Kushner has volunteered to share with Congress what he knows about these meetings, and he will do the same if he's contacted or connected with any other inquiry.
Did the president discuss it, though?
I'm not going to get into what the president did or did not discuss, but what your question assumes is a lot of facts that are not substantiated by anything but anonymous sources that are so far being leaked out.
My colleague Peter Baker had been with President Trump as he traveled overseas last week and is now back in Washington as the president confronts some of the controversies he had left behind.
Just because he was overseas didn't mean the White House wasn't dealing with the controversies back home. And so you had staff here in Washington trying to figure out a damage control plan, how to get this presidency back on track and wall off the investigations that have been distracting, the investigations that now we understand also involve Jared Kushner, the president's son-in-law. So they came up with a plan, and the plan was to hire an outside legal team to create a war room within the White House to keep the questions on these topics away from the main White House briefing room, and to then shake up the communications team at the White House. And you saw the first shot of that today when the communications director, Mike Dubke, announced that he was resigning.
Who is this guy who just left the communications team at the White House? I don't know that I've ever heard his name.
Well, he's a low-profile fella. He did not play a part in the campaign last year. He was a veteran Republican strategist for 25 years, worked for people like Rudy Giuliani, Senator Dan Sullivan. And they brought him in February to basically try to professionalize and, create a working apparatus here. But I think he, like other people who work in this White House and are charged with imposing discipline on the most undisciplined of presidents, found it frustrating. And so he decided to step down. And I think he's not the last change we're going to see in that operation in the next few days.
Do you suspect that the communications director basically resigned because he feels like no one can truly direct communications in this White House?
Well, I think the president, in effect, thinks that. He has made clear that he sees himself as his only truly adequate communicator. He said the other day that he was thinking about abolishing press briefings altogether. Hmm. Maybe it would just be when I get up there, because only when I get up there, in effect, is the message delivered correctly. So I don't think they're going to do that exactly, but they are probably going to scale back these daily briefings and keep the questions about the Russia investigation and so forth away from that main day-to-day place of business.
You mentioned the Russia investigation. I wanted to ask you about Jared Kushner, who you mentioned a little earlier as being someone who's suddenly under scrutiny for a communication that he is alleged to have had with Russia about the idea of setting up a communications channel with that government between the Trump transition team and Russia. I wonder, Peter, you've covered Russia and the United States for quite some time. Is there anything inherently wrong with seeking a secret way of communicating between these two countries?
Well, there's certainly been back channels between Russia and the United States going back for many, many years, certainly. I think there are a couple of things that are unusual about this circumstance. One, of course, is that this is the president's son-in-law. Two, it was done during the transition before, if it was done as it's been reported, it was done during the transition before he took office. Mm-hmm. And three, at least there's some understanding that we were talking about keeping it away from people who otherwise would normally know about a back channel. You would typically have your intelligence chiefs know about it. Mm-hmm. For instance, you would typically have at least some of your top foreign policy people know about it. And this was a circumstance where people who would normally know about that kind of thing were not part of the loop. So I think it's also against the context of this investigation into whether associates of President Trump during the campaign last year had anything to do with Russia's meddling in the election here. And that's what makes us seem a little curious and have raised questions on the part of investigators.
This does seem to be a frustrating time for President Trump. From what you can tell, how does he see the path forward out of this? You mentioned that he wants to wall off the investigation. I wonder if you think that's even possible. And even beyond that, how does he see the way toward the rest of his presidency?
Yeah, it's a good question going forward. I do think, it has to be really frustrating for him because, you know, what he at least has said is a false narrative. The idea that there was somehow collusion with the Russians has come to so absorb, you know, all the energy in his White House right now. This is a White House that hasn't passed a major law yet. Mm-hmm. And it's the White House every day is having to answer questions on this. But of course, he's made it worse in some ways, certainly by firing the FBI director, by then saying that the reason he did it, at least one reason he did it, was because of the Russia investigation. So moving forward, it's hard to see. Right now, ironically, this idea of walling off the investigation is taken from who else? Bill Clinton, who was a master of scandal and having to deal with all sorts of investigations while he was in office. Remember, there were multiple independent counsels during the Clinton administration. And so they became expert in some ways at finding ways of trying to keep governing while they were fending off these attacks. And that's, in effect, what Trump is looking at now, that same model. Can they continue to govern on the issues that are important to them while fending off these attacks on the Russia investigation? So,
And can he?
Well, it's never smooth, even if it does work. But one of the things that all the lawyers have told him and all the lawyers have talked to the White House staff they've talked to is he has to get off Twitter. In other words, he keeps providing ammunition for his critics by saying things, by changing stories, by providing, you know, intemperate tweets that feed into a narrative that he at the same time is trying to dispense with. So, you know, it's that's certainly why a communications director might feel frustrated there and why I think that they're going to have a hard time finding some people to come in and fill some of these slots if they do shake it up.
Peter, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Here's what else you need to know today. The U.S. military says it successfully intercepted a mock long-range missile over the Pacific Ocean on Tuesday, a test of a missile defense system intended to protect against a possible North Korean nuclear strike. That system, known as a bullet hitting a bullet, hits its target about half the time. And
it has been 2.5 years since Tamir Rice was shot and killed here in Cleveland.
And we can tell you the officer who shot Tamir has been fired and his partner that day has been disciplined.
The city of Cleveland has fired Timothy Lohman. Lohman was terminated not for his role in the shooting, but for misleading the Cleveland Police Department about his employment history, including a recommendation by a smaller police department that he be fired for insubordination and lying, an explanation that did not satisfy Rice's mother.
They fired him for lying on his application, which I wish they would have fired him for killing Tamir.
In 2015, a grand jury had declined to bring criminal charges against any of the officers involved in Rice's shooting, setting off national protests against police shootings of young black men. That's it for The Daily. I'm Michael Barbaro. See you tomorrow.